Chapter 20. Sufficient approach to verisimilitude, and the ghastly business went on. You must understand that the scheme of the test he was applying to me was, I gathered, a homeward passage, the sort of passage I would not wish to my bitterest enemy. That imaginary ship seemed to labor under a most comprehensive curse. It's no use enlarging on these never-ending misfortunes. Suffice it to say that long before the end I would have welcomed with gratitude an opportunity to exchange into the Flying Dutchman. Finally he shoved me into the North Sea, I suppose, and provided me with a lee shore with outlying sandbanks, the Dutch coast presumably. Distance, 8 miles. The evidence of such implacable animosity deprived me of speech for quite half a minute. Well, he said, for our pace had been very smart indeed till then. I will have to think a little, sir. Doesn't look as if there were much time to think, he muttered sardonically from under his hand. No, sir, I said with some warmth. Odd on board a ship I could see. But so many accidents have happened that I really can't remember what there's left for me to work with. Still half averted, and with his eyes concealed, he made unexpectedly a grunting remark. You've done very well. Have I the two anchors at the bow, sir? I asked. Yes. I prepared myself then, as a last hope for the ship, to let them both go in the most effectual manner when his infernal system of testing resourcefulness came into play again. But there's only one cable. You've lost the other. It was exasperating. Then I would back them, if I could, and tail the heaviest hawser on board on the end of the chain before letting go, and if she parted from that, which is quite likely, I would just do nothing. She would have to go. Nothing more to do, eh? No, sir. I could do no more. He gave a bitter half laugh. You could always say your prayers. He got up, stretched himself, and yawned slightly. It was a sallow, strong, unamiable face. He put me in a surly, bored fashion through the usual questions as to lights and signals, and I escaped from the room thankfully past 40 minutes. And again I walked on air along Tower Hill, where so many good men had lost their heads, because, I suppose, they were not resourceful enough to save them. And in my heart of hearts I had no objection to meeting that examiner once more, when the third and last ordeal became due in another year or so. I even hoped I should. I knew the worst of him now, and 40 minutes is not an unreasonable time. Yes, I distinctly hoped. Dot, but not a bit of it. When I presented myself to be examined for master, the examiner who received me was short, plump, with a round, soft face in gray, fluffy whiskers, and fresh, loquacious lips. He commenced operations with an easy-going etsy. Suppose you tell me all you know of charter parties. He kept it up in that style all through, wandering off in the shape of comment in two bits out of his own life, then pulling himself up short and returning to the business in hand. It was very interesting. "Hat's your idea of a jury rudder now?" he queried suddenly, at the end of an instructive anecdote bearing upon the point of stowage. I warned him that I had no experience of a lost rudder at sea, and gave him two classical examples of makeshifts out of a textbook. In exchange he described to me a jury rudder he had invented himself years before, when in command of a 3,000-ton steamer. It was, I declare, the cleverest contrivance imaginable. A be of use to you someday, he concluded. Who will go into steam presently? Everybody goes into steam. There he was wrong. I never went into steam, not really. If I only live long enough I shall become a bizarre relic of a dead barbarism, a sort of monstrous antiquity, the only seaman of the Dark Ages who had never gone into steam, not really. Before the examination was over he imparted to me a few interesting details of the transport service in the time of the Crimean War. The use of wire rigging became general about that time too, he observed. I was a very young master then. That was before you were born. Yes, sir. I am of the year 1857. The mutiny year, he commented, as if to himself, adding in a louder tone, that his ship happened then to be in the Gulf of Bengal, employed under a government charter. Clearly the transport service had been the making of this examiner, who so unexpectedly had given me an insight into his existence, awakening in me the sense of the continuity of that sea life into which I had stepped from outside, giving a touch of human intimacy to the machinery of official relations. I felt adopted. His experience was for me too, as though he had been an ancestor. Writing my long name, it has 12 letters, with laborious care on the slip of blue paper, he remarked. You are of Polish extraction. Born there, sir. He laid down the pen and leaned back to look at me as it were for the first time. Not many of your nationality in our service, I should think. I never remember meeting one either before or after I left the sea. Don't remember ever hearing of one. An inland people, aren't you? I said yes, very much so. We were remote from the sea, not only by situation, but also from a complete absence of indirect association, not being a commercial nation at all, but purely agricultural. He made then the quaint reflection that it was long way for me to come out to begin a sea life, as if sea life were not precisely a life in which one goes a long way from home. I told him, smiling, that no doubt I could have found a ship much nearer my native place, but I had thought to myself that, if I was to be a seaman then I would be a British seaman and no other. It was a matter of deliberate choice. He nodded slightly at that, and as he kept on looking at me interrogatively, I enlarged a little, confessing that I had spent a little time on the way in the Mediterranean and in the West Indies. I did not want to present myself to the British merchant service in an altogether green state. It was no use telling him that my mysterious vocation was so strong that my very wild oats had to be sown at sea. It was the exact truth, but he would not have understood the somewhat exceptional psychology of my seagoing, I fear. I suppose you've never come across one of your countrymen at sea. Have you now? I admitted I never had. The examiner had given himself up to the spirit of gossiping idleness. For myself, I was in no haste to leave that room. Not in the least. The era of examinations was over. I would never again see that friendly man who was a professional ancestor, a sort of grandfather in the craft. Moreover, I had to wait till he dismissed me, and of that there was no sign. As he remained silent, looking at me, I added, but I have heard of one, some years ago. He seems to have been a boy serving his time on board a Liverpool ship, if I am not mistaken. What was his name? I told him. How did you say that? He asked, puckering up his eyes at the uncouth sound. I repeated the name very distinctly. How do you spell it? I told him. He moved his head at the impracticable nature of that name, and observed, it's quite as long as your own, isn't it? There was no hurry. I had passed for master, and I had all the rest of my life before me to make the best of it. That seemed a long time. I went leisurely through a small mental calculation, and said, not quite. Shorter by 2 letters, sir. Is it? The examiner pushed the signed blue slip across the table to me, and rose from his chair. Somehow this seemed a very abrupt ending of our relations, and I felt almost sorry to part from that excellent man, who was master of a ship before the whisper of the sea had reached my cradle. He offered me his hand, and wished me well. He even made a few steps towards the door with me, and ended with good-natured advice. I don't know what may be your plans, but you ought to go into steam. When a man has got his master's certificate, it's the proper time. If I were you, I would go into steam. I thanked him, and shut the door behind me definitely on the era of examinations. But that time I did not walk on air, as on the first 2 occasions. I walked across the hill of many beheadings with measured steps. It was a fact, I said to myself, that I was now a British master mariner beyond a doubt. It was not that I had an exaggerated sense of that very modest achievement, with which, however, luck, opportunity, or any extraneous influence could have had nothing to do. That fact, satisfactory and obscure in itself, had for me a certain ideal significance. It was an answer to certain outspoken skepticism, and even to some not very kind aspersions. I had vindicated myself from what had been cried upon as a stupid obstinacy or a fantastic caprice. I don't mean to say that a whole country had been convulsed by my desire to go to sea. But for a boy between 15 and 16, sensitive enough, in all conscience, the commotion of his little world had seemed a very considerable thing indeed. So considerable that, absurdly enough, the echoes of it linger to this day. I catch myself in hours of solitude and retrospect meeting arguments and charges made 35 years ago by voices now forever still, finding things to say that an assailed boy could not have found, simply because of the mysteriousness of his impulses to himself. I understood no more than the people who called upon me to explain myself. There was no precedent. I verily believe mine was the only case of a boy of my nationality and antecedents taking a, so to speak, standing jump out of his racial surroundings and associations. For you must understand that there was no idea of any sort of arrear in my call. Of Russia or Germany there could be no question. The nationality, the antecedents, made it impossible. The feeling against the Austrian service was not so strong, and I dare say there would have been no difficulty in finding my way into the naval school at Pola. It would have meant 6 months extra grinding at German, perhaps, but I was not past the age of admission, and in other respects I was well qualified. This expedient to palliate my folly was thought of, but not by me. I must admit that in that respect my negative was accepted at once. That order of feeling was comprehensible enough to the most inimical of my critics. I was not called upon to offer explanations. The truth is that what I had in view was not a naval career, but the sea. There seemed no way open to it but through France. I had the language at any rate, and of all the countries in Europe it is with France that Poland has most connection. There were some facilities for having me a little looked after, at first. Letters were being written, answers were being received, arrangements were being made for my departure for Marseille, where an excellent fellow called Solary got it in a roundabout fashion through various French channels, had promised good-naturedly to put Le Jeune Homme in the way of getting a decent ship for his first start, if he really wanted a taste of sea meteor de Chine. I watched all these preparations gratefully, and kept my own counsel. But what I told the last of my examiners was perfectly true. Already the determined resolve, that F.A. seaman, then an English seaman, was formulated in my head though, of course, in the Polish language. I did not know six words of English, and I was astute enough to understand that it was much better to say nothing of my purpose. As it was, I was already looked upon as partly insane, at least by the more distant acquaintances. The principal thing was to get away. I put my trust in the good-natured Solary's very civil letter to my uncle, though I was shocked a little by the phrase about the meteor de Chine. This Solary Baptiston, when I beheld him in the flesh, turned out a quite young man, very good-looking, with a fine black, short beard, a fresh complexion, and soft merry black eyes. He was as jovial and good-natured as any boy could desire. I was still asleep in my room in a modest hotel near the quays of the Old Port, after the fatigues of the journey via Vienna, Zurich, Lyons, when he burst in flinging the shutters open to the sun of Provence and chiding me boisterously for lying abed. How pleasantly he startled me by his noisy objurgations, to be up and off instantly for a 3 years campaign in the South Seas. Oh, magic words! Une campagne de Troyes and stands les mers du sud, that is the French for a 3 years deep water voyage. He gave me a delightful waking, and his friendliness was unwearied. but I fear he did not enter upon the quest for a ship for me in a very solemn spirit. He had been at sea himself, but had left off at the age of 25, finding he could earn his living on shore in a much more agreeable manner. He was related to an incredible number of Marseille well-to-do families of a certain class. One of his uncles was a shipbroker of good standing, with a large connection amongst English ships. Other relatives of his dealt in ship's stores, owned sail lofts, sold chains and anchors, were master stevedores, caulkers, shipwrights. His grandfather, I think, was a dignitary of a kind, the syndic of the pilots. I made acquaintances amongst these people, but mainly amongst the pilots. The very first whole day I ever spent on salt water was by invitation, in a big half-decked pilot boat, cruising under close reefs on the lookout, in misty, blowing weather, for the sails of ships and the smoke of steamers rising out there, beyond the slim and tall planier lighthouse cutting the line of the wind-swept horizon with a white perpendicular stroke. They were hospitable souls, these sturdy provincial seamen. Under the general designation of Le Petit, Amida Baptistin, I was made the guest of the Corporation of Pilots, and had the freedom of their boats night or day. And Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.